talking with Ray Bradbury, of course, at his home. Go ahead. Who called this morning?
Bo Derek called.
Yeah.
See, I sent her a book, We'd Always Have Paris, because in Paris, 25 years ago, she came up to me in a railroad station and said, Mr. Bradbury? I said, yes. She said, I love you. She said, my name is Bo Derek. I said, I couldn't help but notice. She said, will you travel on the train with me? I said, okay. So I traveled on the train with her. I spent 2 days in the south of France with Bo Derek, and she called today to thank me for the book, We'll Always Have Paris. How about that?
That's great. You know, I just read an article, an interview with you in the New York Times.
They mentioned her.
Yeah.
And in the article, she admitted, she said, she loved me.
She must have seen the article and said, I better give Ray a call.
Yeah.
Ray, listen, the reason we're here, of course, is because we couldn't think of a better person to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11 with. And I wonder if you feel as fortunate as I do in the whole history of humanity to have been alive, not just when we first left our planet, but to actually set foot on other worlds.
Well, when I was a young boy, I thought I'll be an old man when we land on the moon. Well, I wasn't old. I was 49 years old. I was very young. And I was in London that night, and I went over to be on the Snow TV show. And instead of introducing me, he introduced Engelbert Humperdinck.
I remember this.
I walked off the show, and the producer came running out after me. He said, what are you doing? I said, that idiot doesn't know this is the most important night in the history of mankind. I will not be on the show with that idiot. He's stupid. Get me out of here. Get me a cab. So I went across London, and I met with Walter Cronkite. I did a broadcast on Telstar at midnight, telling all the reasons why space travel was important and why it was important that we were on the moon, because we were on our way to Mars. And someday we would settle Mars, and then we'd go to Alpha Centauri, and we'd live forever. So this is the first step to living forever. Mankind has got to beat the sun going out or the sun flaring up. So we're going to survive because of this very first step tonight, and that idiot Snow should have had enough brains.
Now, wait, I got to stop you, because you said Snow. It's Frost, right? David Frost?
Pardon me.
That's quite all right. I just didn't want to confuse the audience.
Frost, yeah. I don't know why I use Snow, yeah.
It didn't start then, of course. I mean, I think, you know, of your old friend Arthur C. Clarke, who wished you well on this program shortly after you had your stroke some years ago.
That's right.
He's, of course, passed away now. But it was in his story that he had, you know, a proto-human looking up at the moon and reaching for it and thinking, well, if I could just get to a high enough spot, I could reach it.
Yes. Well, we're all similar people. We have the same dream. And landing on the moon is really dead for us.
Hmm. You were talking, though, before we started to record about, I guess it's okay to be excited about the moon, but your heart is still farther out on that red planet.
Well, see, we've been building flimsy things in space stations, but they're not strong enough. You cannot take off from a space station and go to Mars. We've got to have a solid ground underneath us to build a firm place where we can send rockets to Mars. But it's got to be the moon. And sometime in the next few years, we've got to reestablish ourselves on the moon.
I was distracted here because your kitty was up against my leg here.
That's my Halloween cat.
Hello, Halloween cat. So you do see a role for the moon. You're happy to see that we're on the path to returning humans there?
We should never have left. We've circled the Earth with our rockets and photographed it, and that's good information, but it doesn't help us get to Mars. The moon has got to be a solid underground for us to build factories to go to Mars. And it's going to take 30 or 40 years to establish a base on the moon. And then we'll go to Mars and we'll establish a civilization there, which will last for thousands of years. And then we'll move from Mars to Alpha Centauri, or a planet near there.
You don't sound like you've lost any confidence in the human potential in the universe.
Well, we've done this. We didn't think we could do it, and we did it. It was quite amazing. And I went down, I met with all the astronauts in 1967. I went to Houston, and Life magazine sent me down to interview all the astronauts that were coming up. None of them had any names yet. But Life magazine had a meeting in a room with 70 astronauts. And the editor of Life magazine said, "Young men, I think you might like to know, in the back of the room today is Ray Bradbury." Everybody jumped to their feet. And 70 astronauts ran back and clustered around me because they'd all read the Martian Chronicles. Isn't that wonderful? I'm part of the lunar exploration. It's so wonderful to be loved by these young men who treated me as an equal.
I think you're part of much more than the lunar exploration. I think of the scientists and engineers who were also inspired to do what they've done, who are still inspired, who are still leading the missions that are taking us off of this pale blue dot.
Well, it's wonderful. The night the Viking lander landed on Mars, I was out at JPL, and I was watching the photographs come in on the TV, and I noticed a man behind me, and I turned. It was Wernher von Braun. Hmm. And I didn't want to speak to him. I had mixed feelings. But I realized he was a mixed creature. He was half black, half white. He was half good. Mm. He was half evil. He invented the V-2 rocket that destroyed England, and then he invented the rocket that took us to the moon. So I shook his hand, and he wrote an autograph on a piece of paper for me. "You saw it all ahead of us. You inspired us." And so Wernher von Braun gave me credit for inspiring him to be a rocket engineer. Isn't that beautiful?
I have a surprise for you. That day, that evening, when we were waiting for Viking 1 to land, I was a young college student who I finagled my way into JPL, and I was standing with you in Von Karman Auditorium, and a few other people, the great writer, your colleague Ted Sturgeon, was also standing with us, when Viking landed on Mars.
Yeah, that's right. And I was interviewed by NBC, radio interviewer, TV interviewer. He said, "Ray, how does it feel now that we land on Mars? There are no cities and no people." I said, "Stand back and shut up. We are the Martians. We are the Martians from now on. So shut up and go away." I made him do that.
You put it somewhat like that in the Martian Chronicles, of course, when the parents bring their children out and they look down into the river and they see themselves.
That's right. That's the end of the book, yes.
I remember something else from that day. As we stood in this circle, someone came running up. This is before the Viking landed, and said, "Heinlein is here, Robert Heinlein."
Oh, my God,
and
yeah.
I don't know if it was you or Ted Sturgeon said, "Oh, my goodness, Heinlein is here. I don't know if he's talking to me." But he was upstairs in the cafeteria or something.
Well, Heinlein was a good friend of mine, and he sold my first story for me. Isn't that unbelievable?
Really?
I was 19 years old, and I showed Heinlein a story, and he sent to Script Magazine for me, and they wrote me and said, "We're going to publish this." And it was all because Heinlein gave it to them. I was 19 years old.
Wow.
He gave me a beginning.
I did not know. That's a wonderful story. Did you remain friends?
No, he didn't like me because when the war started, he thought I should have gone out and signed up to be a soldier. And he didn't know that my vision was so bad. I was technically blind. When I went down for the examination, I got to the optometrist, and he said, "Read those letters." I said, "What letters?" He said, "On the card." I said, "What card?" "On the wall." "What wall?" And he said, "Give me your glasses. Let me see." So he looked at my glasses, and he said, "Do you really want to be in the Army?" I said, "I'm not sure." Yeah. Mm. And I wasn't. I became 4F. And so Heinlein didn't like that, though. He thought I shouldn't be a 4F. Well, how could I change my eyes? I couldn't.
I think he was sorry that he couldn't go himself.
That's right. He did a lot of subsidiary work along the way.
Yeah, yeah. When I think of him and I think of that entire family of greats that you are identified with, Heinlein, Asimov, Clark, and some others that us real fans remember.
Oh, a lot of them were my teachers. Edmund Hamilton and Lee Brackett were my friends and teachers. They lived up in Venice a few blocks away from me, and every Sunday afternoon from the age of 21 to 26, I met Lee Brackett at Muscle Beach in Santa Monica, and I read her brilliant stories, and she read my dreadful stories. And finally, I began to write some decent stories. They became part of the Martian Chronicles, and that was all influenced by Norman Corwin, the great radio writer. He was my friend that encouraged me about writing on Mars. And also, a wonderful thing happened after I published the Martian Chronicles. A fan wrote me 10 years later and said, "Mr. Bradbury, has anybody noticed that Martian Chronicles was influenced by The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck?" And I wrote back and said, "Yes, I read Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath when I was 19 years old. I loved the book, and every other chapter is prose poetry. It's not fiction. So if you read Grapes of Wrath, you're not reading a novel. Every other chapter is prose poetry." So I learned how to write prose poetry, and I put that in the Martian Chronicles, and every other chapter is not a story, it's prose poetry. And Aldous Huxley, the great author of The Brave New World, invited me over in 1950. He wanted to meet me because he had just read the Martian Chronicles. And I went to have tea with him, and Mr. Huxley leaned forward and said, "Mr. Bradbury, do you know what you are?" I said, "What am I?" He said, "You're a poet. You're a poet." I said, "Oh, my God, I always wanted to be a poet. I never was in high school. I never made it. But thank God for John Steinbeck and Grapes of Wrath. He taught me how to write prose poetry."
Well, you've mentioned, I mean, Norman Corwin, Steinbeck, people who are great heroes of mine. But I think of somebody else who, if anybody had a claim on being called the first Martian other than you, it was Burroughs, Edgar Rice Burroughs, who was your early inspiration.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, he wrote 8 or 9 books about Mars. And in one of his books, The Gods of Mars, John Carter goes out and stands on the lawn of summer and raises his hands toward Mars and says, "Mars, take me home." And Mars took him home. So when I was 12 years old, I did the same thing. I went out on the lawn and I said to Mars, "Take me home." He took me home, and I've never been back. And that was the month I became a writer. I was 12 years old. And my first story was a sequel to a story by Edgar Rice Burroughs. So Mars has been in my life, all of my life.
Didn't you say you still have that toy typewriter?
It's downstairs. It's on a table. You can see it. Yep.
Yeah, I remember those with the wheel that you turned to the letter you wanted.
It takes you forever to write just a sentence.
Well, I guess writing takes patience and dedication.
That's right. Yeah.
I can't remember. It's been so long because I started reading you in junior high, and that was when I got through R is for Rocket and S is for Space and Golden Apples of the Sun. Did you write any stories about the moon? I could not remember, and I didn't take the trouble to look it up.
Strangely enough, I never did. It was always Mars.
Yeah. Well, you certainly had the focus there. Anything that you've written recently that involves Mars? I mean, I do want to note that you have, it just came out in February, a collection of stories and a poem from the poet Ray Bradbury, We'll Always Have Paris, which was just published this year.
That's right, yeah. But I'm anxious. I'm going to give you, when you leave today, the DVD of the broadcast I made the night we landed on the moon and was with David Frost. And I want you to take and make copies and give to all your friends, because in a half hour I explained why space travel was important, why the moon was important, and I want everyone in the world to see this DVD of me that night 40 years ago. When I left that broadcast at the BBC in London, I walked across London laughing and crying all the way. It took me 6 hours to walk back to my hotel. I didn't take a taxi cab. I wanted to be in London all alone with myself and my joy. And I got back to the hotel, and out in front there was a tabloid that said, Neil Armstrong walks on the moon, Bradbury walks at midnight. They report I walked off the David Frost show. And so I hated him so much. But it's good to have that headline. Me and Naya, Neil Armstrong, in a single newspaper, the morning after we landed on the moon.
The DVD is right here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm going to take it with you, yeah, and give them to lots of people. I want people to see this. Very important.
I didn't even know that you had this.
So. Oh, I've had it for a long time, yeah.
So you said you went across town, and you were with Walter Cronkite, an old friend of yours who's ailing now, I've heard, but always seemed to share a lot of your feelings about our accomplishments in space.
Walter Cronkite was wonderful, yeah.
And he seemed, though, to really get caught up in it, in our accomplishments in space, the way that you did.
He was wonderful. And many years later, when I helped invent the Epcot, I'm a verbal architect, I helped build Epcot. The main building at Epcot is Spaceship Earth. I wrote the text and the metaphors for that, and Walter Cronkite spoke that introduction for me inside the building.
I've heard it. Yeah.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
There are still young people who discover your work. Some of it, of course, has very little to do with space, but The Martian Chronicles, which certainly appears that it will live on forever. And they continue to be inspired by this. That has to give you some special satisfaction.
It's wonderful. And it's being created as an opera in Chicago. And I've got a copy of the material. I'm going to send it down to the opera company here in L.A. and hope to bring the Martian Chronicles opera out from Chicago and put it on the stage here.
You are also very active already on the stages in Southern California. Your productions come up periodically, and in fact, there's one running right now. It runs through August 29th called Yestermorrows.
That's right, yeah.
You want to say anything about that?
Well, it's 3 one-act plays. One is a play called The Meadow. My first play appeared on the stage at Huntington Hartford 50 years ago. It was my first play on the stage. So if you see it, you'll see the first play I ever wrote. And the second play is part of Dandelion Wine, which I wrote as a novel and as a musical and as a play also. And the third is a story called Cistern that was published in Mademoiselle magazine. So you see, I'm all over the place.
Yeah, you still are the Mr. Multimedia.
Yeah.
And the other book we mentioned a few minutes ago, this We'll Always Have Paris, which has a great cover of you standing in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
That, can you tell us a little bit about that, since that's your latest in print?
Well, I've been madly in love with France and Paris for 50 years. I go back every year on Bastille Day. And on one occasion, I was up on the slope across from the Eiffel Tower. I was with the bombardiers, and I helped fire fireworks over the Eiffel Tower. I did that from the top of a building 30 years ago. So this new book is all about my love of Paris and going every year for 40 years.
You've had a great deal of fun in the better part of a century, haven't you?
Life is fun. You must never give up on life. I feel sorry for writers who don't believe in life the way I do. See, I have a gift. I remember being born. Very unusual. Most people don't know that. But I was a 10-month baby. I stayed in the womb 10 months instead of 9 months. And when I was in the womb, I developed my seeing and my hearing. No wonder I remember being in the womb, too. I could see all around me the pink-red color of my mother's womb. Huh. And so when I was born, I remember hearing myself, yeah. My seeing was so good. And many years later, I checked with my mother, and I said, Mama, how many days did you suckle me? She said, 3 days. I said, I remember the flavor. And I said, how many days after I was born was I circumcised? She said, 5 days. I said, it wasn't at home, was it? No. Wasn't it the hospital? No. Did my father bundle me up and walk me downtown and walk up some stairs and put me on a table, and a man in white leaned over me with something bright in his hand, and I felt the pain, and that was the circumcision. So I was 5 days old, and I remember that. So isn't it great to have a recall like that?
I think I'd probably go without that memory if I had a choice, but that's got to have contributed to what you've been able to do with your life and the things that you've created.
And everything else, too. When I was 3 years old, I saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame with Lon Chaney, silent film, 1923. And I saw The Phantom of the Opera when I was 6, and I loved that, Lon Chaney. I saw a dinosaur film when I was 6 years old. I fell in love with dinosaurs, and they changed my life forever. I wrote about dinosaurs when I was 30, and I met a young man along the way, Ray Harryhausen, and we worked on a film together because we both loved dinosaurs. So you see, total recall is very important. I remember every damned thing about my life from the very first moment inside the womb.
The one thing that I did do last night, the one bit of writing that I did write, I did read, just because I got caught up in it again, and I don't know how many years it had been. I read The Foghorn. Is it the opening story in which collection? Is it Golden Apples of the Sun, of course, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was almost a dinosaur story.
Well, I gave that book to John Huston. I admired his films. I had lunch one day with him in 1951. Guess what day? St. Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. A great day to start a love affair with a great director. I gave him all of my books. And he went to Africa to make The African Queen. And he wrote me from Africa. He said, I've read your books. I think someday we're going to work together. So in 1953, he gave me the job of writing Moby Dick. And when I was in Ireland with him, I said, how did I get this job? He said, I read your story, The Foghorn. And in the middle of the story is that prose poem about the invention of the foghorn. And I said to myself, Jesus Christ, this is Herman Melville's bastard son. So I gave you the job. That's how I got it, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, me too. And of course, yeah, Moby Dick, another story about another monster, right?
Coming out of the sea, yeah.
Yeah. There's much history left to be made in something like 10 years. Humans will walk on the moon again. If we're lucky, in something like 20 or 30 years, they'll walk on Mars for the first time. If you had a message for these future explorers, does anything come to mind that you might want them to hear from
no,
the past?
No, I want everybody listening to me to think of Mars, only Mars, again and again and again. And think of going back to the moon and make sure the government hears this from you. These are bad times today. If you read the Wall Street Journal, forget it, you know. If you buy stocks, sell them. Get rid of them. But listen to me and say, back to the moon. The moon is everything, and Mars is beyond, waiting for us. I want to be buried on Mars. I don't want to be the first live person to arrive there. It'd be too late, but I want to be the first dead person that gets there. I want to arrive in a Campbell's soup can and bury me on Mars in a thing called the Bradbury Abyss. They got to name a place on Mars for me, and I will welcome that.
I would love to see that happen. From your mouth to NASA's ears, and I'm going to see what I can do to help make that happen.
I hope they're listening.
Yeah, me too, me too. I know we've got NASA folks out there, so everybody out there who works for the agency, keep that request in mind. I don't want to keep you any longer, unless there's anything else you'd like to add. I mentioned to your daughter, Alexandra, who very kindly arranged for this conversation, that if you wanted to read a poem, we'd certainly be thrilled to hear one.
No, I just want to pass a message to everyone about living. Number one, God goes in my left ear and goes through my brain and comes out the right ear, and leaves the gossamer behind. When I wake up in the morning, God has left gossamer there for me to read. I get out of bed and write a story. I wish this gift to you. Do what you love and love what you do. You're looking at someone here who spent his life doing what he loved and loving what he did. And that is my message to you. And Pope Bradbury bid you all good night.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you for all of those stories. That's perfect.